Hi, everyone. This is Tim with TacticsTime.com, and today I have a very special guest, Pete Short. And for those of you in the Colorado chess world, Pete needs no introduction. But for the rest of you, Pete's a longtime friend of mine, chess wingman. We used to work together and would play blitz in his office at work during lunch and after work, and we're regulars at the Denver Chess Club, and we've traveled all over the country together, been to multiple different states and big tournaments. So welcome, Pete.
Hey, thanks, Tim. I appreciate the invitation to come on to your site. You're doing a great job with Tactics Time. You always have in the Colorado Chess Informant, so it's fun to see it finally online.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, that's how it started. It started doing a monthly column called Tactics Time, where I would publish tactics from area chess players. And so, yeah, it's
well, the funny thing about you and tactics is that you became the first guru to preach tactics. You were the first person to bring the De La Mosse school of thought to the table, despite the fact that we have another friend who shall remain nameless, Shannon Fox, who believed in strategy, right? It's all
right.
About strategy, and you countered that with chess's 99% tactics and 1% Shannon with his head up his ass. But other than that, it's been fun to watch you develop that into an article.
Well, thanks. Yeah, just so everyone knows what the background is on that, you know, I discovered Michael De La Mosse's article, How to Gain 400 Points in 400 Days, and that basically became my new religion as far as chess was concerned. And one quick story that just popped in my head was when I first started hanging out with the Raytheon crew, Shannon invited me and Pete over to his house to to play. Do you want to tell this story, Pete?
Well, I'll start it off, but you got to finish it, Tim. So,
yeah.
So Shannon had just moved into a new house, and we came over to see him. And Shannon, in all seriousness, has been a great friend of ours for years.
Yeah.
And so I'd known Shannon for a number of years, and Tim was our new friend. And in chess, it's very like much like prison. You have to stick with your homies, and the new guy on the block has to be tested. And I think that's where you come in, Tim. You were the new guy on the cell block, and we really weren't sure who you were, but you were the bone that Shannon tried to chew.
Yeah, and just stepping back a little bit before that, when I first met Pete, I was with a different coworker, and I had to go into his office to do some paperwork or something, and this guy John and Pete start talking about chess, and I didn't really let on that, you know, that I was pretty serious about chess and into chess, and they mentioned that they were going to play at lunch, and I was like, oh, you know, can I come? And so I sit down, and I proceed to play John the first game, like kind of acting like I had no idea anything about chess, and then I beat him in like 10 or 12 moves, you know, and then Pete's eyes just lit up like, wow, we got a new chess player, you know.
We got a new bitch on the cell block.
Yeah, exactly. So anyways, I met Shannon shortly after that, and so he invited us to his house to play, and do you want to pick it up from there, Pete?
Oh, yeah, again, you know, we were there. Shannon invited us over, and I'm playing Shannon in a game, and you have to understand in chess, there's serious chess, and then there's chess that you're supposed to play with your friends, which I think equates in some people's minds that you play them, and then they like to talk for I don't know, 30 minutes about how they could have beaten you in post-mortem analysis. But I
well, the thing I remember is that you and Shannon were playing a semi-serious game, you know, not just a five-minute game, but, I don't know, it was a 30-minute game.
Oh, and you came in from outside, that's right.
Yeah, then I came in, and then I was watching it, and then I don't know exactly. I think maybe you won on time, or I don't know what. I don't know exactly what happened, but I remember saying, like, oh, well, you could do this and this and that, and, you know, I was pointing out a bunch of, like, forcing tactics, you know, and I was only rated like 1100 at the time or something. And then I've totally burst Shannon's bubble, I think, cause he had won, but then I was pointing out how you had a bunch of wins. And then he was basically like, well, you're only 1100. So you should like shut up and learn.
<That's>
something.
Right. Which is ironic because at that time, I don't believe you were 1100, but you were rated lower than Shannon, and I believe
yeah, I was rated lower
over,
than all you guys. Yeah.
Over time, you beat Shannon like 97 consecutive times in tournament play. Was that right?
Well, then you know I started studying tactics like really religiously, and then I jumped from like a D player to a B player like straight away. You know, I started really kicking some butt at the DCC, but anyways, you know, it's all in good fun. And
oh, it was all in good fun.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And again, you know, chess is not a sport where there are hallmark moments.
Yeah. So speaking of the DCC, we used to have a lot of fun going down there on Tuesday nights. There are always quite a lot of characters running around.
Yeah, there's a lot of stories from the DCC. And, you know, the funny thing is that the DCC was a step up from the PS1 that was located on Bannock down the street. That it was just was terrible. But, yeah, we had a lot of fun at the DCC because if you didn't play at the VFW for the DCC, you didn't go through the bar, the smoke-filled Denver still had smoking in the bar,
right,
up the stairs into the dance hall-like room that was filled with about 70 degenerates that we called friends, and they called DCC membership. And, you know, the great thing about chess is that it's not me. It's the other person, that Stinky Bob and the unemployed guy and the Cyclops and Boots and all of these strange assorted characters, the fat bastard who shall remain nameless.
Right.
All of these people are really us, except
right,
we don't view ourselves as them.
Right, yeah, exactly.
But collectively, the great thing about chess is that it doesn't matter who you are, doesn't matter if you're white or black, your age, your gender, your sexual orientation, your sexual preference,
right,
your physical ability, it brings it all to bear on the board, and that's what's fun. Unfortunately, we got kicked out of the VFW, which I've been kicked out of a lot of bars, but never playing chess.
Yeah, I remember that, and you even called the local news channel. Wasn't that part of the thing? Because they threw us out on the street, and there's a bunch of chess players standing around.
Yeah, that was a Tuesday night I should never forget, because I wanted to play chess that night.
Yeah.
I didn't really care about the plight of mankind or whether we
right,
ever played there again. But,
right,
again, I live in Elizabeth, so when I drive someplace,
yeah,
I want to play chess or go to the grocery store or
right,
do whatever. So we get there, and it's really there's a backstory there. We became the organization filled with controversy. And
right,
you kind of have to go back in time. That's a whole other story. But yeah,
right,
we were ceremoniously kicked out on a club night, and there we were out on the street, and everybody was ready to go home. So we said, hey, nobody leave, and hey, let's set up all the boards with the kids on the sidewalk by the traffic, because their parents had left them, right?
Right.
Tyler Hughes and all of these kids, they don't have their
yeah,
parents. They're there alone. We can't leave, really, because I could have. But anyways, I know some of you had conscience and you couldn't have left those kids there. But I thought I'd use the kids, exploit their plight for my own desire to play a rugged game of chess. So I said, hey, let's set up the boards, and I'll call the news media. And, you know, the great thing about the news media is that they'll chase anything, apparently. So it was probably a slow news night.
Well, in Denver, too, they're like, literally right around the corner from there. Like
they were on Spear and Bannock.
Yeah, exactly.
So lo and behold, after calling a couple of stations, the news van actually showed up. And, of course, you know, I sold the story that all these kids have been kicked out of the VFW and there's some adults making sure that they're not buggered in the street. And now they're playing games on the sidewalk. And all they need is shelter until their parents pick them up. So they show up. And of course, you know, it's pretty funny because, you know, I walked in with the news crew up to the manager of the bar, and you know, he doesn't know me. I'm the guy who, you know, goes up and plays chess and drinks a couple of beers and is loud and obnoxious, so I don't have any real standing with him. So I basically, you know, suddenly I'm Cesar Chavez in the grape fields in California, right? I've got a mission in life, albeit short, to raise the plight of the downtrodden chess player to the evening news, or play chess, right? So,
right. So
this poor news guy standing there, and I bargain with the guy that the story goes away if we get to play chess tonight. And
yeah.
He looks at the news crew, and the guy's ready to light up the camera, and he spits and says, "Okay, you can play chess just one more night." And I look at the news crew and go, "Sorry about your story," and I walked off. So
yeah, that was brilliant. I mean, you're definitely never afraid to, you know, escalate things or, you know, I mean,
blow things out of proportion for my own gain.
But yeah, that was great. And you wrote a controversial blog post on my other chess blog, timmybx.com, called Clogs and Plungers, A Brief History of the Denver Chess Club. Do you want to touch on that a little bit? Like how
it was more of a labor of love and potentially certainly I put more time into that than any paper I put into college. But again, the topic was more interesting. So basically I tried to chronicle the short, unhappy history of Denver chess. And again, I think if you go back in Wiki Chess in Denver, you get these great stories like Bobby Fischer playing in a candidates match against, who was it? Started with a T.
Mark Taminoff.
Whatever. I know just a little bit more about chess history than Francisco Balthier, and I like it that way. But
where he crushed him like 11-0, right?
Yeah, he crushed him 11-0, and I think he broke a finger and he couldn't play the piano anymore, something like that. But that's the story of Denver chess, right? You've got Bobby Fischer here, and you've got all of this history of these great players. But by the time we get there, you know, we're playing chess in the PS1 childcare thing where it smells like urine. Why does it smell like urine? Because little boys like to go for distance. Not necessarily accuracy, apparently. And these boys apparently could go the distance. The place smelled like urine. The tournament director was some loud guy who was half deaf, but it's in my article, of course, that he couldn't hear, so he's bellowing. So I lasted about 3 games and quit chess for 2 years. 3 games, 2 years hiatus.
Yeah.
So my buddy Shannon, the guy that we've spoken of, he convinces me, Pete, you got to come back. And I come back, and we're in Bannock now. We're in the VFW, and times seemed good. Times were good until an adult actually beat up a kid in the parking lot.
Oh, geez.
Well, you remember that was the Philip Pomneroff thing. Philip was completely righteous in that situation just because he was an over-stimulated, young, obnoxious, self-righteous Russian. Doesn't mean that an adult has a right to beat him up.
Right, yeah.
And fortunately for Philip's father was able to come to his aid almost. Philip's father had quite a history, Tim. Spassky's, not second, but what was he?
I'm actually not sure. I never really heard that story.
Well, most of your listeners probably don't know anything, so let's just say he was Spassky second, but I think he was on the psychological team.
He was part of his team. Yeah.
But anyways, in all fairness to these guys, there was a little bit of rub in the community and a lot of division in people. Probably the big fallout was two people I have a great deal of respect for, J.C. McNeil and Paul Grimm, were running the club as president and vice president, and it caused ultimately their departure from the club. And
right.
Somewhere in between, somebody clogged the toilet. I'm not sure if somebody cranked a hoagie sideways or maliciously broke a piece of plumbing. But, again, you know, we left PS1 because it stunk like urine. We got kicked out of the VFW because of a toilet issue. So now we're homeless, thus the video story. So now we got to have a place because the next Tuesday we don't have a place to go. So fortunately we had a new player again, another new guy, Joe Haynes. Joe's a nice guy, well intentioned. he ran a nonprofit in the ground, but he had a nonprofit called what
like
was
Campfire
it?
Girls
Campfire Girls or Girls of the Midnight Sun or some small group of girls who get together at a cabin and sing Kumbaya. Well, you know, Joe, probably why he ran the nonprofit in the ground, he felt like he had total run of the place. So he invited us to come by his cabin out in the woods where these little girls are usually around. And we started playing chess there. And, you know, it was kind of idyllic in the beginning. You know, you parked on the grass. You had to drive all the way up Sheridan in the middle of nowhere. And, you know, it was kind of quaint. You know, it's like, hey, we're playing chess in the cabin. And so we're all being cool. We're all going up there. And then you realize, you know, the windows are open because there's no air conditioning. So in the summertime, it's hot as hell. In the wintertime, the snow's blowing in. There's only one bathroom, and there's, you know, 172 guys standing in line trying to take a whiz. So fortunately, we were in a cabin in the woods, and I think on more than one occasion, we availed ourselves of the thing, another continuing theme, right? It's it's the bathroom that brought us down. But so we didn't get kicked out of there, though, in all fairness to things. We didn't get kicked out because somebody did it. We got kicked out because the place went bankrupt and they had to sell it to, I'm not sure, a lumber mill or something to cut the trees down. So we get kicked out of there. And Joe, by then, you know, because we're all happy we got a place to be. So, you know, in order to be thankful for him, somehow he becomes president of the Denver Chess Club.
Right.
And we then went to a church, right? I don't remember where it was at, but that was the place we called the bunker, right, the dungeon.
Was that the one by the Cherry Creek Mall?
Yeah, that was it.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So,
where people were literally bringing their own lamps and flashlights.
Exactly.
And
exactly. It was the crypt.
Candelabras.
Exactly. Exactly. So we're down there. Nobody can see. It's stuffy. It's smelly. And my favorite part of the whole time there was every time we had to play a game, Joe Haynes would have to say, and there'll be no fighting, and make sure that you flush twice so you don't clog the toilet. And I thought it was funny the first 22 Tuesdays in a row that he said that, but it kind of got old after that.
Right.
And I don't remember why we got kicked out of there, but we did. It probably had to do...
I think someone broke a toilet there, too. I mean,
of course,
you know,
why not clogs and plungers? So somebody broke a toilet. We play chess Tuesday nights, fight, have personality disorders, and apparently we have a fetish for toilets. So we get kicked out of there, but we found another church. And this was this the last church, the second to the last church? I don't remember, but... To make a long story short, membership starts to dwindle because the church now, and by the way, I thought churches were houses of God and were wonderful places, but we're down in the basement, and again, basement theme. And they charge us a fortune. We play chess down there. Membership dwindles. They have to raise the prices of chess players, and quality starts to drop off. And meanwhile, I'm traveling back and forth from when I was living remotely, and all I wanted to do when I came home was play chess with my buddies, and there it was. From the moment I got there, there was a plunger in a urinal in the toilet with a sign at the time that says, do not use, out of order. But over the next, I don't know, 14, 16 months, as that plunger starts to decompose from the well-intended chess players who are still pissing in that toilet, and the reek's running on the thing, and it's terrible, and nobody's taking the time to A, fix it, or B, remove the plunger and nasty sign.
Yeah.
And I actually took a picture of that for the article.
Yeah,
it was really kind of
a symbolic metaphor of the Denver
Yeah, it was the plunger, man. It's clogs and blunders. So
yeah.
at the end of that, we didn't get kicked out of there. We should have kicked them out they actually took care of the toilet for us. It's like, you guys can't break our toilet; it's already broken. So that was actually brilliant. I'm probably part of our lease negotiation. So there we were, out of a place to go because, quite frankly, we couldn't afford the rates anymore. So then they wound up in the IHOP, and that's where I'll leave the listener to go to one of my favorite websites, timmybx.com, and read both of my articles, The Short Unhappy Life of the Denver Chess Club, Clogs and Plungers, and some obscure piece of work I wrote on the IHOP.
Yeah, those are brilliant. Those are totally hilarious. So yeah, that's great stuff, Pete. So where would you say has been your favorite tournament or your favorite place to play? Or
oh, that's easy. That would be the Woodstock of Chess, Minneapolis, Minnesota. The Global Chess Challenge.
Yeah, that was awesome. You want to tell listeners what that was?
Oh, that's great. So if you're a U.S. chess member, USCF member, you get a magazine called Chess Life, which is interesting, topical. It's a great place to find tournaments. But on the cover of one is Maurice Ashley, one of the up-and-coming U.S. chess players over time that never really amounted to anything. Like they all didn't. And he's standing in front of, what was it, 2 Brinks trucks in Minneapolis with them open and all this money there. And literally, here's Maurice Ashley saying, we're guaranteeing $500,000 prize fund in support of a charity to help the little learning disability children in Minnesota have a better future by giving you a guarantee of $500,000. So, of course, chess players have one delusional fantasy, and that is that regardless of their playing ability, that if you put $500,000 down, somebody can win it, and that person could be me, like it was a lottery. So I believe perhaps it was the largest Colorado chess turnout in years, and it was in Minnesota. There were about 40 of us, and you can check the USCF page on exactly how many it is, but it wasn't like we took the pride of American chess there. There were the Tom Mullikins and myself and Tim and Brian Wall and Anthea Carson and a whole assortment of folks like Chris Peterson and others who, quite frankly, may have had different expectations of how their trip would go. But I know one thing, Tim. It didn't cost us anything.
Right.
You might want to tell that story. I like to hear it from your perspective.
Well, yeah. So, you know, this was the must-go-to event of the decade, basically, for a chess player. Like Pete said, the Woodstock of chess. So Pete's main problem was, you know, how am I going to get to go, you know? So he came up with a brilliant scheme, you know. So he talked to the HR people at our company and gave them this line of bullshit about how you know, chess play, how this would be a great recruiting opportunity, because at the time we were hiring and they were having a hard time finding engineers, and how they could, you know, they need to start thinking outside the box, and how this big chess tournament in Minnesota would be this great recruiting opportunity, and how he'd be happy to, you know, help man the booth, and that he knew a fellow chess player, being me, who was also willing to help, and all they'd have to do is pay for our hotel and travel expenses and food and
of course,
to the
but from an ethical perspective, we did pay our entry fee.
Yeah, we did pay our entry fee,
but that's about it. Yeah, that's
and we did spend a couple minutes at the booth in between rounds.
Highly productive minutes.
Right. So
it was such a good idea that I pulled it off again at the World Opening next year. But hey, that's a different story.
Yeah. So Radeon was a corporate sponsor of the HB Global Challenge, and we had a booth there, and we were handing out, you know, little, I don't know what, frisbees, I don't even remember.
Raytheon calculator, so.
Calculator, right.
And I'm proud to say this, you know, if we had not done that, Tim, the children of Africa would not have gotten that box of calculators that we gave that guy who said he was going to take it to some village in Sierra Leone or Swaziland or Congo
right.
or wherever. But I'm quite confident now, 5-6 years down the line, that there's a couple of MIT students who got a scholarship because of those calculators.
Yeah, we definitely made a difference.
We made a difference. I made a difference on my rating too. Not as positive as I had hoped. So. But it
right.
was a great tournament. It was a lot of fun, and it demonstrates that you are among your friends when you go there. The real funny thing is what happened to HB Global, our HB Global Foundation.
Yeah, speaking of running nonprofits into the ground.
So they guaranteed the prize fund at $500,000 now. There's one businessman in chess, if there's any, and that's Bill Gorchberg. And Bill
right.
Gorchberg will promise you a prize fund of $18 million, but it's not guaranteed. And that's based on 19 million players. Which he'll never get. So typically his prize funds say, you know, $250,000 prize fund based on 30,000 entrants. And when you get to the tournament, you win. It's actually so little money that they can't put it into currency. So you get a coupon at an Arby's in town and you walk away. But that's not fair to Bill Gorchberg. He's a fine human being, I'm sure. He does have good prize funds, but he's a businessman, so he doesn't guarantee
right.
anything. Maurice Ashley, he doesn't care. He got some good publicity. He got a
right.
lot of good publicity, which I think he wrote a book about that, on how to take care of children through chess and examples in life. When probably the greatest example was, if you're going to guarantee something, don't front the money yourself. So this nonprofit, HB Global, who's hoping to raise money, right?
Right.
Raise money, not give it away. They guaranteed $500,000, and they had, what, every three chess players had their own tournament director and somebody walking around. And Josh
yeah.
Waitzkin, who I was disappointed in talking about chess, talked about Tai Chi, I think, with you. On a one-on-one session at breakfast one day, which they paid for, and you know, it was great, and but at the end of the tournament, they only had about a third of the people that they needed to break even, and so they lost money, and HB Global Foundation was bankrupt, and the children were turned out to the street, and I believe that was after they elected Jesse Ventura, so it didn't get any better in Minnesota,
right.
And then the whole Favre thing. Right? You got Favre
yeah.
in Minnesota. So that state really should be given back to Canada.
Yeah, really.
Sure.
And then the Randy Moss thing really.
Right,
sealed the
right,
deal.
Right. Doesn't help Minnesota at all.
But, yeah, I mean, there's a reason Goitsburg's been around for 30 years running tournaments, and they only lasted once. I mean, I remember you and I going in the gift shop on the last night, the Sunday night, and they had about, you know, 300, you know, printed beer steins and stuff.
Because
said,
what chess player doesn't go to a tournament and dream of bringing back in their carry-on baggage a beer stein?
Yeah. I mean, they had glasses and mugs and coffee cups and boards and magnets. I mean, you know, they had $10,000 worth of stuff in the gift shop. You know?
Oh yeah, yeah. They literally were yeah, like drunk sailors out on Carnival. It was great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
And again, the real key there is that if you're a director of a nonprofit and you play chess, you might need to consider a change in one of the two, because you're probably
yeah.
not good at either one collectively.
Yeah, right.
So
yeah.
No offense, definitely. Joe, if you're listening to this, you really were a good CB level player. You really were.
Right. So we've gone out to Reno a couple of times. They run a pretty
good
show.
Oh, God,
out
that's
there.
A great time, isn't it?
Yeah.
Isn't it? Yeah. I had to smoke while I was there because I did smoke with Tim a lot. I like that. But I had to smoke to ensure I didn't die of secondhand smoke. It was actually healthier to smoke in Reno than to breathe the secondhand smoke, which potentially was more toxic.
Yeah, the Reno tournaments are held at the San Regency, and if you ever want a good laugh, go on to Yelp.com and read some of the reviews about the place. It's
you can get a cheap meal at Arby's, and I think they sell bed bug bite cream pretty cheaply across the street. Yeah. Actually, you know, most Vegas shows have topless dancers, and the Sands just has bed rug races. But I'll tell you, in all seriousness, a lot of fun memories from Reno, mainly because that's the first time we were able to get any combination of all of us to the same place at the same time. Six people at one tournament, biggest pain in the ass I've ever been a part of.
Six Raytheon people, you mean?
Six Raytheon people.
Yeah.
So we had Robert, don't call me Bob Beckman, Troy Oberg,
right,
Francisco Baltier, Shannon Fox, Tim Brennan, and Pete Short, all in one
yeah.
place, all one tournament.
Yeah, that was great.
The only time the six of us were in one place on the same page was when we had a photo taken on the bridge, and the rest of the time it was maddening chaos. It was
yeah.
a complete pain in the ass. And what else happened on that trip?
Well, the biggest thing that comes to my mind with Reno is Francisco having an achievement that none of us will ever be able to top.
All hail. Well, you had an achievement the year before in Reno that hadn't been topped either, but go ahead with that.
Well, I missed part of it, so you might be able to fill in the pieces better than
me. Oh, yeah. We had a simul. So simuls are a good time. We were playing seven-time Walter Brown. He was called seven-time Walter Brown because he won the U.S. championship seven times. So here he is, the revered.
Did you play in that also?
What's that?
Did you play in that also?
Oh yeah, but by the time
okay.
you got there, I'd already been timed out by Walter Brown.
Okay.
But, so we're all excited. We're sitting there, and the great thing about simuls is that the guy who's playing simul gets to choose the color, which is always white, and so he's walking around making his moves, and Francisco, who's become a student of the Brian Wall School of the Fishing Pole.
Right.
Starts playing his fishing pole variation. And he was going quite well, but you came into the critical part. You actually videotaped
right.
this and put it on YouTube.
Yeah, that was my first YouTube video. I think it's up to 7,000 hits or something. It's crazy. But yeah, go ahead.
Oh, and so during the course of the game, you know, potsers like me are dwindling out and going to the bar and getting drinks and coming back and meeting friends who are coming in from flights, but there's Cisco still sitting there, and Walter Brown starting to sweat. And, you know, if you've ever seen the fishing pole, it's amazing how you watching the game feel like you know exactly what to do, but the person playing is in panic mode, and you're starting to see Walter Brown go into panic mode.
Yeah.
And by the way, if you've ever stood and watched one of Cisco games, it's actually unhealthy. It's actually unhealthy. Because if you're watching his games and you've got a weak heart, you're going to drop dead.
Yeah.
If you're an alcoholic, you'll go to the bar.
Yeah, that was me.
Yeah. If It's not for the week apart. And quite frankly, neither are Shannon's games. But fortunately, anything that you miss in Shannon's games, real or perceived, will be replayed to you in postmortem analysis. So it helps out a lot. You don't have to even watch Shannon's games at tournaments because he'll fill you in.
Yeah.
And, there's no reason to see it and then hear it because it really cuts down on the – on the factor of trying to say, no, Shannon, actually, you didn't have a queen at that part of the game.
Right.
But he always seems to have one in postmortem analysis. So, but back to Cisco, the great news of the fact is that he takes an obscure opening that's been championed in the Denver community by Brian Wall. He's put it to test against a legitimate grandmaster, a legitimate U.S. player, and as a lifetime C++ player touching the B rung a couple of times, Francisco Baltier beats the only person to beat Walter Brown in this tournament, and it was an exciting moment for all of us. So
yeah,
was
it was.
Cool.
I mean, you know, I just remember there being like it was a pretty big simul. There were maybe 30 people in the simul, and Walter Brown was kind of walking around and cruising, you know, making moves pretty quickly. But, you know, he'd get to Francisco's table and he'd just be standing there for a minute or two, which really, you know, is not the simul etiquette. You know, you're supposed to kind of make your move and go on. But he was going into some deep things, and Francisco had this, you know, shit-eating grin on his face the whole time. And you and I think, were like, don't get too cocky, dude, you know, because, you know, in hindsight, you know, it's easy to see that he won, but at the time, you know, he's, like you said, he's playing this, you know, 6-7-time U.S. champion, and we're like, don't F this up, man, you know, you're winning, and, you know, then it was kind of like, you know, people started whispering, hey, look at this guy's position, and people were standing around, and, you know,
he literally became a cult hero that night for everybody who watched him.
Yeah, and I mean, that game's kind of taken on a life of its own afterward, you know. I mean, I've seen it posted on blogs. Some guy posted it in a book that he wrote and self-published. And
it's ironic that Brian Wall revolutionized the fishing pole and Francisco Baltier took the game that everybody will remember.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, too, it's like Francisco is one of these guys that if you say, you know, hey, what is the English opening? He may or may not even know what that is, you know.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it was great.
Well, I mean, that might be a bad example, but if you say, I mean, he's not like Mr. Encyclopedia of openings. I mean, he hasn't really studied a ton of stuff, but, you know, he really took to the fishing pole and he really spent a lot of time, you know, playing through Brian's games and reading Brian's email list and, you know,
So really when you talk about Francisco and Shannon, they're polar opposites.
Yeah, definitely.
Francisco doesn't understand strategy and Shannon thinks that the sun rises by a pawn chain regardless of how impacted it may be.
Right. Yeah, definitely.
Hey, you remember when we went to Florida?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so yeah, I'm living in Florida, and I'm trying to think of excuses why people can come out and play chess. So Tim wants to come to the Space Coast Challenge in Cocoa Beach. So how did that tournament go, Tim?
Well, you know, I don't remember that much about the actual games, but there's a funny story at the end of the tournament, which I just wrote about for Paul Anderson's email list. And so after my last round game, it was kind of a long game, and it was one of those things where, like, you know, it was kind of drawish, and there was no way for anyone to make any progress, but the other guy was refusing to take a draw. So, you know, he kind of dragged it out. And then finally we agreed to the draw. So afterwards I went outside to smoke a cigarette, and then I come back in and I just left all my stuff at the board, you know, because it's pretty typical chess crowd, you know, kids and dads and, you know, people running around in wheelchairs and, you know, all kind of stuff. So, you know, so I come back and I notice that my sunglasses are gone. And, you know, they were fairly expensive sunglasses and I had just gotten them. And, you know, I was in Florida, so I kind of needed them. And I was like, you know, where are my sunglasses? You know, so my opponent was standing right there. And I'm like, hey, you know, have you seen my sunglasses? And he's like, yeah, Carl picked them up. And I'm like, Carl, you know, who's that? You know, it's like, oh, it's my son's friend. You know, he's a good kid. He must have thought you lost him and turned him in or something. So I'm like, okay. So I go down to the lost and found, and at the hotel, I'm like, did anyone turn in my sunglasses? I mean, to me, they weren't lost. I mean, I purposely left them there, you know, along with my clock and my set and everything else. And they're like, no, we don't have any sunglasses. And so I asked a couple other kids, you know, hey, you know, this kid Carl. And they're like, yeah, I haven't seen him, you know. So right about that time, Pete finishes up his game. And by this time, I had spent, you know, 10, 15 minutes trying to find my sunglasses. And at that point, I was out of options. You know, I didn't know what to do. So I said to Pete, and I'll let you pick up the story from here, Pete. I was like, Pete, I'm calling in the wolf here.
And when you're out of options, that's what you got to do.
Yeah.
You got to call in
yeah.
the wolf.
Yeah.
So I'm playing my game, and quite literally, you know, the proof is in the USCF ratings page. I was having a really crappy tournament, and then I played this guy, and of course I win my last round, which is great about being a poor class player, that no matter how badly you play, somebody's playing worse. So I'm feeling pretty good, long game. I get through with my game, and I see Tim. He's been very active, bouncing around, talking to people, moving around, and then he's sitting patiently waiting. So he says, I need to call in the wolf, and I ask him what's going on, and he fills in the blank about the sunglasses. Well, it was pretty evident to me that I wasn't going to allow my friend to come to Florida and have his sunglasses taken and have my drive back, you know, ruined by some punk-ass kid who's taking sunglasses. So I've got to go into action. So
yeah.
So it's evident immediately that Carl has he's blown the coop. He's there. He's obviously a scholastic player and an older scholastic player, not one of the cute little ones that wear the Teddy Ruxpin T-shirts, but one of the teenagers who think they can steal people's sunglasses. So he's out of there. He's going out. And so
just a little background for people who may not know you. You know, you work as a professional investigator, so you know you have a lot of experience in this type of thing.
Right. So, you know, I didn't give up my semi-pro status when I did this investigation, but certainly I may have been around the block with perps before.
Sorry, but go ahead, yeah.
So the first thing you got to do when you do an investigation is you've got to get the facts. And I'm not really concerned with the facts as much as I'm concerned with finding out where my perp is. So the first
right.
thing you got to do is you got to sweat somebody. So if you're going to sweat at somebody, sweat a kid. So I picked out this kid who's kind of a little overweight and goofy looking and figured I could sweat him. So I took him off to the side and I was asking him about Carl. And he admitted to me that he went to school with Carl. So that was pretty good. And we all know that if you're a big goofy fat kid, somebody is going to pick on you. And fortunately for me, that kid was Carl. So now I've got me a stoolie. I got somebody I can sweat. So I convinced the kid that he would be doing a big service to me and certainly exacting some level of revenge on Carl by giving me Carl's cell phone number, even despite the fact that his parents had, A, told him not to talk to strangers, and, B, probably explained that things like phone numbers are are probably considered private information, but nonetheless, I had the cell phone number, so I've got that part of it. But I don't just want to talk to Carl; I'd like to talk to his parents, and so we had to figure out who's got the key to the parents, and that's always the tournament director. So the tournament director's, you know, he's managing the last round, and again, lots of scholastic players there. The parents are all gathered around. They're going to have a trophy ceremony. You know, you got to show a good show because you need these people to come back next year. So he's getting ready for that. And then I pop in and basically say, look, you've got a kid here who just stole a pair of sunglasses. And, of course, he wants to ask me questions like, how do you know the sunglasses were stolen? And, of course, I don't have time for that nonsense. So I pretty much said, it's not important why I know the sunglasses were stolen. It's important that you know that I know the sunglasses were stolen by this kid named Carl. You remember what his last name was so we can completely destroy his reputation over the airwaves?
Carl Scarpotti. Yeah, you were in Jack Bauer mode. Where every second is critical, you know.
Absolutely, it was. And actually, if you filmed that, you would have seen a little clock on the side ticking down.
Yeah, so. It's like. Beep,
exactly,
beep.
Because I'm going to catch Carl, right? Wherever Carl is, I've got to catch up to him, right? I'm the Grim Reaper at this point. I'm the wolf. I'm
right.
coming for him. I'm the shadow of his future. So I told the tournament director, I need the Carl's. Parents' contact information. Well, this is my favorite part of the story because, as any good tournament director, and again, I am in a security organization, I am an investigator, I understand the importance of maintaining confidentiality of records and things that people give you. So the tournament director rightly told me, I'm sorry, sir, but I can't release that information to you. So I understood that. I respected that. But I also informed the tournament director that a crime had been committed during the course of his event. And that as such, that crime constituted the need to bring in law enforcement. And law enforcement, especially in a place like Cocoa Beach, especially with someone like myself completely connected to the quote-unquote aerospace industry,
right.
would bring the full weight and force of the Cocoa Beach Police Department upon the hotel where the tournament was about to have their trophy ceremony, and
right.
that I would ensure that detectives would calm the audience, talking to scholastic players, one and all, about the theft of the sunglasses in front of the parents, who then would probably be concerned that next year they would not want to return to this den of iniquity that we call a chess tournament. So
yeah,
as I'm continuing to browbeat him, he's writing the telephone number out, up there, hands it to me with the hope, of course, that I will go away quietly so
yeah.
he may proceed
yeah.
with the tournament.
Yeah, so, and we never did involve the police. We took matters into our own hands, you know.
But we believed that we were bringing in the police.
Yeah, right.
That.
Oh, yeah, that was brilliant. That was brilliant.
So then Tim and I, for lack of anything other than the enthusiasm, must make up ground as we've learned that Carl is on the road. We have his home phone number. We have his cell phone number. And we have something that no one, not even Jack Bauer, would count on, and that is my lovely bride in Colorado, who was available to take our call and begin a nationwide search for Carl, his family, his residence, his history. And as we're driving out of Cocoa Beach city limits, we get a call back. Audrey has a photograph of Carl Scarpotti. Fortunately for us, was the editor of the high school that he was at in newspaper. The home address and real estate value of the home that he lived in. Several other things, and so we begin our drive. So now we know we're going to Orlando, which conveniently for me was on the way to Tampa, where we were heading for the end of the tournament. So as we're driving.
Yeah, Audrey was like the Chloe O'Brien of to Jack Bauer, you know, sending info on the PDA, you know. It's like, damn it, Chloe, I need it now, you know.
We're driving along. I'm throwing money in tolls. I got the phone in one hand. I'm just doing this stuff. We're half laughing about this. But then we begin calling Carl as we get close to Orlando. And nobody's picking up phones. So just through the point of reference that I am now heading to Carl's home. I have every intention of showing up on his doorstep.
Right.
Carl's not answering his phone. I leave a message with Carl basically saying, I'm coming to your house. You have my friend's sunglasses.
Yeah.
So you need to pick up the phone. The next time I call you, it's in the best interest of you that you answer the phone, because otherwise I will come with the police. And if you try to leave the house, I will know it. I may have made that part up, but it sounded good. But anyways,
you did threaten to involve the local police in Orlando.
Oh,
well.
Absolutely. I was going to show up with the police, and we, at that point, I believed it. Then I called the home number. And of course, nobody picked up there, but I knew the parents would answer the home number, because what kid is allowed to answer the parents' phone when he's got a cell phone? So I left a message there.
And they may not even have been home yet, because it was a little bit of a drive to Orlando from Cocoa.
Yeah, they probably went to a restaurant or something like that.
Right.
So then I left a message to the parents. To the parents of Carl, your son has stolen a pair of very expensive sunglasses from my friend Tim. He was witness stealing these sunglasses. I am driving to whatever the address was. I quoted it out to the zip code level.
Yeah.
I'm coming there to retrieve the sunglasses. If they are not immediately surrendered to me, I will bring the Orlando Police Department there. I will press charges despite any subsequent wish to return the sunglasses. So I'm on my way. If you want to talk with me, you need to call me at this number.
Right.
And then a few minutes later, we called Carl back, and Carl answered. So I'm assuming that Carl may have listened to the message. And I believe my message to Carl was, Carl, don't hang up.
Yeah.
You stole my friend's sunglasses, and I'm coming to your house to retrieve them.
Right.
And you could take over from here.
Well, this is the funniest part of the story, because Pete's on speakerphone. And he's like, Carl, don't hang up. And then he's like, I didn't steal them or whatever. And then you hear the mom in this, like, kind of thick Ukrainian accent, like, screaming, like, Carl, you told me you found those sunglasses. And then the mom gets on the phone, and, you know, she doesn't want any problems. She doesn't want us to call IMS.
I think what I told Carl at that point when his mom was screaming, I said, Carl, you might want to give your mom the telephone.
Yeah. Right. So the mom gets on the phone, and, she's completely cooperative and embarrassed, and she gets my address. And
Only because I basically said, I want those sunglasses now. I'm coming to your house.
Yes.
Oh, no, sir, please don't come over to the house. Mr. Man, please don't come over to the house. I promise to get the sunglasses back.
Yeah.
You better promise, because if you don't, I want you to know I live in Tampa, and I will come back.
So,
did you get the sunglasses back?
Yeah, I did. I got them back, and that was great, and got a great story out of it too. You know, so yeah, that was awesome, man. That was awesome on your part. That was fantastic. So.
Do you notice that my stories at chess tournaments are always better than my performance at chess tournaments?
Yeah, probably in that case it definitely was. And I mean, that story is not exaggerated at all. I mean, that's pretty much word for word the way it happened, you know. So that was awesome, man. So, well, thanks, Pete. This has been great. You know, this some funny stuff, and I think the listeners will really like that. So,
well, I appreciate it. If you want to invite me back, I'll tell you the story of the Cheetos in Memphis.
Yeah, that's a great story too. So. All right, man. Well, thanks. I'm going to close it out here. So this is Tim Brennan with TacticsTime.com, and thanks for listening. Bye.